Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, Christopher Jones-Cruz, and Katie Weaver. Later, Marcia James will bring us this week's People in America report. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
China suffered its worst air pollution of the year recently. More than 70 Chinese cities released warnings to citizens in the last few days about pollution reaching dangerous levels. The poor air quality led the government to order factories, some power plants, and schools to close. But there were reports that some local officials were not obeying the orders. In one city in northern Hubei province, people wrote on social media that schools were kept open, although the area had the highest pollution threat. Media reports in the central province of Hunan also showed pictures of students completing school activities in the dirty open air. State-run news agency Xinhua reported that an official in Hunan province said factory production was continuing. The official said up to 4,000 factories had not stopped or limited production as ordered by the government. Records of power use at the factories showed little change in the amount of production. The Ministry of Environmental Protection said in a statement Monday that only a small number of businesses had not taken the ban seriously and continued operations. Driving restrictions were also put in effect, and hundreds of flights were delayed or canceled in Beijing because of poor visibility. The ministry said more than 100,000 drivers in Beijing had been fined for violating the traffic bans. The World Health Organization measures air quality by the amount of small particles in it, known as PM2.5. Small particles of this size are easily breathed in and can damage the lungs. The WHO identifies a safe level of air quality as containing 10 to 25 micrograms per cubic meter of PM2.5. Beijing reached dangerous levels of more than 400 micrograms per cubic meter this week. Weather officials were predicting that nighttime winds could finally push out much of the pollution from Beijing and other cities by Thursday. Ma Yongliang is a professor with Tsinghua University's School of Environment. He said temporary government restrictions will not solve the nation's pollution problems over a long period of time. In the long run, the pollution problem can only be eased by adjusting the country's industrial structure or accelerating the upgrading of polluting industries so as to cut down the emission sources of pollutants, Ma said. The professor praised the government's efforts to reduce carbon dioxide after an action plan was started in 2013. But the increased use of coal in winter for heating homes is still a big problem. Reducing these emissions will remain difficult for China's government as it attempts to find cleaner energy alternatives. I'm Brian Lynn.
In many parts of Africa, communities have electricity service that sometimes does not operate, and many rural settlements are cut off from electricity-producing centers. But industry experts say off-grid solar power is becoming available to a number of communities. Off-grid solar energy is energy that is captured from the sun without being connected to a nation's main electricity centers. The United States government is investing millions of dollars in solar technology through its Power Africa project. The International Energy Agency says more than 600 million people in Africa have no way to get electricity. New technology, however, could help solve this problem. The price of off-grid solar energy systems has decreased sharply. Today, people can rent solar equipment for less than 50 cents a day, and they can pay for the electricity as they need it. Lumos Global is among the companies offering solar energy services in Nigeria. The company's chief operating officer, Nir Maram, says putting the equipment in place is simple.
He puts the system on the roof. He puts the indoor unit in the home. There's a cable to connect in between them. It's a plug on both sides. You don't need to be an electrician or anything like this. And then you need to charge this by credit. So the sun charges the electricity, but you need to provide the credit to power the system up. And you do this using your mobile phone.
The company received financing from the U.S. government's Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC. The effort is part of President Barack Obama's Power Africa project. As the off-grid solar energy industry expands, several African countries have also invested millions of dollars in large solar plants. These power centers are on-grid, meaning they are connected to the country's electrical wires and power stations. Senegal opened one of Africa's largest solar plants in October. It is able to produce 20 megawatts of electricity. That is enough for 160,000 people. Chief Executive Charlotte Obi Kalejian heads Greenwish Partners. The company paid for the construction of the solar plant in Senegal. Obi Kalejian says a solar farm in Senegal can produce twice the amount of electricity that a farm of the same size in Britain or in northern France could produce. The International Energy Agency predicts that almost a billion people in sub-Saharan Africa will have on-grid electricity by 2040. But, the agency says, 500 million people will still be off-grid. Investors believe solar power could serve those people while also helping to reduce gases linked to climate change. I'm Alice Bryant.
Many parts of the United States were first territories, with the plan that they would someday become states. Former territories include Oklahoma, which became a state in 1907, New Mexico and Arizona, which became states in 1912, and Hawaii and Alaska, which became states in 1959. But in the late 19th and early 20th century, some areas came under the U.S. government's control without any plan for them to ever become states. Today, many of these areas operate as territories under the Office of Insular Affairs in the Department of the Interior. Puerto Rico. About 3.5 million people live in Puerto Rico. The Department of the Interior does not administer this territory. More people live in Puerto Rico than all of the other territories combined. The island has a larger land area than either Rhode Island or Delaware. If Puerto Rico were a state, it would have the 29th largest population in the country. In a special election in 2012, a majority of Puerto Ricans said they did not want to remain a territory. But while voters clearly rejected their territorial status, it was not clear if they wanted the island to become a state, an independent country, or a country with a formal relationship with the United States. Almost 3 years ago, Congress approved a federally supported referendum that would pay for Puerto Rico to hold another vote to say clearly what they want. The current governor does not want Puerto Rico to become a state, so he has not taken steps to create a ballot for the referendum. U.S. Virgin Islands. The U.S. Virgin Islands is about 65 kilometers east of Puerto Rico. It is about twice the size of the District of Columbia. The USVI has three main islands, St. Thomas, St. John, and St. Croix. About 103,000 people live in the territory. Guam. American military bases occupy more than one quarter of the island of Guam, which is about 550 square kilometers. About 161,000 people live on Guam. It is the largest and southernmost of the Mariana Islands, which are in the northwestern Pacific Ocean. Northern Mariana Islands. There are 15 islands in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. The Commonwealth includes all islands in the Mariana Archipelago except Guam. About 52,000 people live on the three main islands in the Commonwealth. American Samoa. About 54,000 people live in American Samoa, which has three major islands, two small islands, and two coral atolls. The area covers about 199 square kilometers. That is a little larger than Washington, D.C. American Samoa is the southernmost U.S. territory and the only inhabited U.S. territory south of the equator. It is in the Oceania group of islands in the South Pacific Ocean, about halfway between Hawaii and New Zealand. U.S. citizens can travel to all of the U.S. territories without a passport except American Samoa. That is because American Samoa has its own immigration agency and sets its own rules. American Samoa has its own constitution, as do Puerto Rico and the Northern Mariana Islands. Uninhabited territories. There are 8 uninhabited atoll, coral reef, or island U.S. territories in the Pacific. They are Palmyra Atoll, Baker Island, Howland Island, Jarvis Island, Johnson Atoll, Kingman Reef, Midway Atoll, and Wake Atoll. There are 3 uninhabited island U.S. territories in the Caribbean: Bajo Nuevo Bank, Navassa Island, and Serenia Bank. Other countries dispute the U.S. control of some of these territories.
If you or your children are eagerly waiting for Santa to arrive, you can watch his progress with a Santa tracker. Google has been tracking Santa every December for 12 years. This year, Google's tracker takes you to Santa's village, which is filled with new ways to follow Santa. Head to Google Santa Tracker to find a countdown clock to Christmas Eve and 24 different activities to pass the time before Santa arrives. Visitors to the site can see translations of Christmas expressions using Google Translate in Santa's village. You can learn terms in more than 25 languages, including Elvish. We are not sure that language will be very useful, however. There are also games on Google Santa Tracker, such as Gift Slingshot, Santa Search, and Penguin Dash. Google's Santa Tracker is also available on Santa Tracker app for Android, the Chrome Santa Tracker extension, and a link in Google Maps to Santa's village. NORAD continues its tradition of tracking Santa with its NORAD Santa Tracker website. The North American Aerospace Defense Command is celebrating its 61st year of tracking Santa by offering a Christmas countdown, games, activities, 2D and 3D training maps, Santa camera videos, and more. Listen to NORAD Christmas music while you explore the North Pole. Play games, watch videos, and learn the history of how a child dialing a wrong number led to the tradition of NORAD tracking Santa. You can also watch movies about the NORAD Santa Tracker and see a 360-degree view of Santa's village. The NORAD Santa Tracker website is available in 8 different languages. Visitors can watch streaming videos of Santa as he prepares for his flight on December 24th. NORAD Santa Tracker is also available via apps for Android and iPhone and iPad. I'm Katie Weaver.
Matthew Fineau knows a lot about wine. He sees it as a combination of science and art. From watching the weather and checking the soil, to testing grapes for sugar levels and acidity, and then deciding when to harvest, Fino says nature and winemaker must work together.
So what I do is I change grapes in wine. So that's the easy part of it. But my job is it's a blend of farming, of science and arts. Because we need Mother Nature to ripen the grapes and to make grapes good, to make good wine. So that's the nature part. I need science to understand all the fermentation part and the aging part and everything that happens to the wine. And I need the artistic part, that is what makes each winemaker unique and what makes brings the human factors into producing wine. And that's the reason why wine is being considered very often as a kind of art, and there's a sense of artistic feeling into winemaking that I really appreciate.
Fino comes from a family of viticulturists and wine lovers. It was a natural for him to follow that path. He began his study early on his grandparents' farm.
I was very proud of my roots of being a farmer, and that's what I wanted to be. So I'm coming from a northern Rhone area in France, in Crozes Hermitage, and the family farm was apricots, cherries, pear, and vines. That's my roots. We had like goats, we had a lot of things like that at my grandmother's house. But when I came a little bit later in age, after high school, when I had to decide what I wanted to do for a living, I was passionate by wine, and that's my father's side too, where my father loved wine and always when I was a kid, my father made me try good wine, and I really loved that.
Fino knew studying winemaking would be a good link between his love of wine, his love of dirt, and his roots in farming.
So I've studied viticulture and enology, and I went to Beaune in Burgundy to study that. So it's a school in Beaune that give you training and practice about how to take care of a vineyard and how to make wine out of it.
After graduating in 1995, Fino worked in many different wine regions around France to learn all he could about wine.
I've traveled a lot in France to go get into plenty of different wine regions. So I've been in the Burgundy area, been in the Rhone area, been in Jura, I've been in Provence, I've been in Bordeaux area. So I've been traveling a lot in France to learn different techniques of winemaking. And for me, traveling was a part of learning. Not only learning about winemaking, but you also learn a lot about yourself. And that's the best part of traveling. And you learn that not everybody thinks the way you do, and you learn to listen to people, and it's not all about you. And that's a very good thing that I've learned.
Matthew Fino has also worked in Italy and South Africa to learn about winemaking and to gain international experience. In 2003, he came to the United States, and he settled in Virginia.
And I wanted to go to New Zealand. But before going to New Zealand, I wanted to come to the United States. And that was in 2003. I was planning to stay here for 6 months and then go to the Southern Hemisphere and go to New Zealand. It happened that I'm still here 13 years after. So I guess I've been stuck here for some reason. When I first arrived here, I didn't know where was Virginia on the map, to be honest. I'd never been to the United States before. That was my first time here. I had to look where was Charlottesville on the map too. Never heard of it. And really, I had no expectation. it turned out to be that I'm loving it here. And it's a great place to live.
Matthew works at King Family Vineyards. He says winemaking is new to the state of Virginia.
So here in Virginia and at King Family Vineyards, Virginia is a fairly new wine region. So we are still working a lot about experimenting to try to see what fits the best our climate. We are a hot and humid climate, and so it's not the most ideal weather to ripen grapes. Grapes like usually more dry weather. So we're still experimenting with what does well for us here. But at King Family Vineyards and in Central Virginia, we do like to work with, in white wine, we do like to work with Viognier. We do like to work with Chardonnay. I think that works very well for us here. And when it comes to red, most of the grapes that grows in Bordeaux grows very well here also. So that's what we do at King Family Vineyards.
Matthew Fino says one does not have to know a lot about wine to understand or enjoy it.
If you go to an art show, you don't need to have a lot of knowledge to say if you like this painting or if you like this one. And you might have one that you're not going to like at all because, like, oh, I found that completely ugly. But at the same time, some people would say, like, oh, no, that's wonderful. That's just a nice piece of art. With wine, it's the same. It's not because your neighbor is going to like this specific wine that you have to like it. I think people think they need to learn a lot about the wine to see if they like it or not. What really matters on a tasting is what do you like?
Making wine is a process. Fino says the process for making red and white wine is different for each one.
And there's basic rules. Let's say that on a white wine, the basic rule is you're going to press the grapes, get some juice, and then ferment the juice in liquid form. And that you're going to change grape juice into wine, white wine. On the reds, you want to get some tannin and the color. And tannin and color are in the skin, not in the pulp, in the skin. So you need the skin. So what we do for the reds, we ferment the red with the whole berries. So this fermentation process takes 2 or 3 weeks, and sometimes even more, to get the color and the tannins out of the berries. So it's a two different process. If you ask me what tannin means, tannins is what's good for your heart, and that's the reason why people saying like, oh, drinking wine is healthy. That's mainly the tannins that are very strong antioxidant. And what tannin is, if you don't drink wine, I hope you drink tea. And if you drink tea, and if you let your tea being infused for too long, the drying sensation that you've got out of the tea leaves are tannins.
Matthew Fino says there is something important for all drinkers to remember about wine. It is meant to be enjoyed.
Wine is just a way to have a good time. If you lose this idea of having a good time while you're drinking wine, then what's the purpose of wine? I mean, if it's not your job like mine. Purpose of wine is just to make you happy. So at the end, it's not something serious. I mean, we can take it seriously, and I make a living out of it, so in some way it's serious for me. But wine is not something serious. It's just a way to enjoy life. And I think people should just drink what they like. At the end of the day, you should be happy with having a glass of wine. If you force yourself drinking a glass of wine and you don't like it, don't drink it. Drink something else.
I'm Marcia James.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.